Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello, this is Mike Horton for the White Horse Inn, and we are winding up our series on sanctification, taking a look in this particular program at the Christian's responsibility in the world. What does sanctification have to do with the world? Well, we've seen what a generation's worth of apathy toward theology and doctrinal thinking can produce in moral terms. Even though Christians pour more energy into moral crusades than almost any other pursuit, Christians themselves don't appear to live any differently or, for that matter, think differently. One statistician puts it this way. Survey data supply ample evidence of the bankruptcy of the commonly held worldviews of Christians. It is undeniable that as a body, American Christians have fallen prey to materialism, hedonism, and even to a jaded form of Christianity that rejects much of the commitment required of faithful servants. A recent national survey discovered that no fewer than 7 out of 10 Christians are prone to hedonistic attitudes about life, end quote. Further, about 2 in 5 evangelical Christians, quote, deny the possibility that pain or suffering could possibly be a means of becoming a better, more mature individual. As a final example, 3 out of 10 Christians agreed that nothing in life is more important than having fun and being happy. By contrast, secular historians are baffled by the enormous influence the Protestant reformers had in changing the whole character of the Western world when that wasn't even its primary intent. How could a movement produce so much fruit in moral, social, and even political terms when, as Luther insisted, others attack the life, I attack the doctrine? The first objective, you see, was to preach the word, especially the gospel, and administer the sacraments of baptism and Holy Communion. The Reformed also added a third mark of the church, church discipline. In other words, the Reformers thought the root problem of individual and societal collapse was spiritual and theological, not first of all moral or political. Consequently, that great movement of God created a distinctive character that, even when it didn't succeed, aimed at glorifying God and enjoying Him forever, seeing duty to neighbor as a tangible means of doing just that. They were saved by grace and by grace alone, so selfish motivations such as fear of punishment and hope of rewards weren't theologically justified, even when sometimes ignorantly employed. In his Freedom of the Christian, Martin Luther drew from the doctrine of justification by grace alone an ethic without self-interest, that is, fear of punishment and hope of rewards as its motivation. John Calvin offered similar sentiments when he wrote to Cardinal Sadoleto the following comments. It is not very sound theology, he said, to confine a man's thoughts so much to himself, and not to set before him as the prime motive of his existence zeal to illustrate the glory of God. For we are born first of all for God and not for ourselves. It is certainly the part of the Christian to ascend higher than merely to seek and secure the salvation of his own soul. I am persuaded, therefore, that there is no man imbued with true piety who will not consider as insipid that long and labored exhortation to zeal for heavenly life, a zeal which keeps a man entirely devoted to himself and doesn't even by one expression arouse him to sanctify the name of God for the world. That's our subject, sanctifying the name of God for the world, sanctification and the world. I'm Mike Horton, teach at Westminster Seminary in California. The Reverend Ken Jones is pastor of Greater Union Baptist Church in Compton, California. Dr. Rod Rosenblatt teaches theology at Concordia University in Irvine, California, and is a Lutheran minister. Dr. Kim Riddlebarger is pastor of Christ Reformed Church in Anaheim, California. And we're talking about sanctification. Kim and Rod, what do you think about the statements that Luther and Calvin made that I used in the opening, that the Christian is, as Luther put it, the servant of all and the master of none, and yet the master of all and the servant mm-hmm. of none, that paradox, mm-hmm. and then Calvin's comments also, that a theology of works righteousness will force us to focus on ourselves,
right.
a theology of grace will force us to look outward to help others.
To Christ, neighbor, yeah. It was one of the geniuses of the Reformation, both the magisterial reformers, to speak of that. And it's one of our greatest weaknesses in American Christianity, ironically.
Including our own traditions.
Absolutely.
Right now. Yeah. Yeah.
I have kids at Concordia who've never read any Luther but the Small Catechism, if I'm lucky. And so that one little booklet, saddle stitch, stapled booklet on Christian liberty or the freedom of the Christian, it's variously translated, is sometimes the only Luther that they've read other than the catechism.
And isn't it wonderful that the theology is better than the individuals? I mean, Luther and Calvin presented much better, because they were getting it from the scriptures, they presented a much better theology of the Christian's relationship to the world than they evidenced in their own ministries. Mm-hmm. Calvin, for instance, with Satellito, and Luther with the peasants,
sure,
and with his statements about the Jews and so,
sure,
forth.
Sure.
The theology is better than the practice.
Right.
But it's kind of interesting with Calvin, especially when he talks about works righteousness and the self-centeredness that it leads to. We see it in our day in that our works righteousness has really led to a subculture of Christianity, where we are in the world, but we isolate ourselves from the world. And really, as when you look at the reformers' view of the vocation and the place of Christians in the world, it's completely different. We don't have to hide from the world. We can be fully integrated into society while maintaining a distinction, as we've talked about before, between the two kingdoms.
What was Ken Meyer's brilliant comment that because of the creation, as you say, Ken, of the evangelical subculture, evangelicals are of the world but not in the
world.
They're worldlier than anybody.
Yeah.
They've cut themselves off from the world so as not to be worldly.
It's the biggest irony.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's because of this notion that if the whole process begins and ends with an act of the will, then from then on, everything else that grows out of that is going to be self-centered and understood from the perspective of the will.
I remember I was speaking to a group of school kids at a Christian school, a Christian high school, and I asked them, raise your hands if you agree with this statement. The chief motivation for holiness is the fear of punishment and the hope of rewards.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, that came from John Wesley. Wesley said he couldn't believe in the doctrine of election because it undermined the chief motivation for holiness, fear of punishment and hope of rewards. Asked him, raise your hand. Almost all of the hands went up.
Mm-hmm.
And then I asked them immediately after that, what's wrong with that? And scores of hands shot up again. And I asked, okay, what is the problem? And they were all interrupting each other, shouting out, it's selfish. And I said, then why did you raise your hand?
Absolutely. Yeah. Exactly.
But see, they didn't know what else to do.
Right.
This is the, not paradox, the contradiction we're living with as Christians at the end of the 20th century. On the one hand, we have a theology that tells us we better pursue holiness so that we can get something out of it at the end. And yet over here, that genuine holiness isn't selfish. And if that doesn't create schizophrenia, I don't know what will. I'll never forget the excitement I had when the theology of grace freed me up for the first time to think about my neighbor without thinking about saving my own neck.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Right.
Why help him fix his roof? Because it's leaking.
Yeah, right. And it's not because he's a Christian.
No.
It's not
absolutely.
Because he's
right.
a moral
point.
Person.
He's created in God's image.
He might be a homosexual.
Yeah.
But if he needs his roof fixed, he needs his roof fixed.
He's created in the image of God.
Paul makes an interesting statement in 1 Corinthians 5 when he really lays it on the Corinthians for not exercising church discipline. And then he says, I wrote to you before not to keep company with extortioners and those who are sexually immoral. Did you think I meant the sexually immoral? Moral of this world.
Right.
If that were the case, you'd have to leave it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's such a great.
Yeah. It is. No, I'm talking about hypocritical Christians.
Yeah,
exactly.
He says, I'm talking about those who claim to be brothers.
Yeah.
Those are the ones.
We draw from them, not from the world.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
We need some distinctions here. This, as in so many other areas, what theology is so helpful for, at least good theology, take it out of the scriptures, is it gives us categories. So that when we run up to questions, we kind of know where other things are on the map that would keep us from going into extremes. Let's look at some of those distinctions. First of all, creation, or common grace, and redemption, saving grace. Why is that distinction important?
Because that gives us a grid to understand the dignity of the non-Christian and the fact that the non-Christian is also an image bearer and is suppressing the truth and unrighteousness, and therefore they live in an intellectual schizophrenia that you know, knowing that God has revealed himself and knowing that God has ought against them, sinfully suppressing it, they have the categories in place by which to hear the law and the gospel. It also helps explain why there is truth in non-Christian religions. Why, for example, a Mormon practicing family home evening is going to revolutionize their household because that's from common grace and general revelation. It also shows why such people are guilty before God because they take the good which God has given and use it against him.
So family, labor, vocation.
Culture. Mm-hmm.
Culture. Mm-hmm. All of these things predate the fall.
Absolutely.
They're rooted, they're anchored in creation, and therefore when people go around saying things like, we have to redeem culture, or we have to redeem the family, or we have to redeem the Philadelphia Symphony, they're getting their wires crossed. Those things are anchored in creation before the fall, and it's a part of common grace. God preserves them, but they'll never be saved. They'll never be redeemed.
That's a category that we seem to have lost. You don't really hear. On both sides, even among, unfortunately, among many Reformed people, we really don't have a clear and consistent conception of common grace.
Well, on our side, we've got some confusion in the matter because we have one obscure part of our tradition which denies common grace altogether and sees everything as a spinoff of election. Mm-hmm. And that they would argue, I'm thinking the Protestant Reformed would argue, that grace is never used to the non-Christian, and yet the category exists throughout Scripture that God is gracious to the non-Christian. And we also, in the whole apologetic thing, have the debate with Evantilians and the evidentialists about the common ground and all of that. And, and the debate gets colored by the fact that, well, there's no neutral common – well, everyone agrees that there is no neutral common ground. If you take the fall seriously, then you take suppression of the truth and unrighteousness seriously. So on the Reform side, there have been some peripheral debates that have obscured a good, healthy discussion of common grace and the role that it should play in terms of how we as Christians relate to non-Christians.
Related to this, natural revelation and special revelation.
Well, again, classic distinction is natural revelation is God revealing himself in and through that which he has made, special revelation being God revealing himself in and through history, the person of Christ primarily.
And Scriptures makes it clear that natural revelation is evident to all. I mean, if you look even in Psalms 19 and then even in Romans 1, Scriptures are very clear that these things have been revealed to all, but a special revelation that is redemptive.
Yeah, in our day, we just need to say, though we hold with Scripture that there is such a thing as natural revelation, that it is through and through, beginning to end, a revelation of law, not gospel.
Absolutely.
And all that stuff about, you know, kind of New Age-ish rainbow and the sunset and most of Hallmark greeting cards is not Christ. Yep. It is law. It is nature read in tooth and claw.
The whole Santa Claus story was a good case of law. You know, he knows if you've been good or bad, the whole thing. That so permeates the culture.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Paul says in 2 Corinthians, he says, if my gospel is veiled, it's veiled to those whose minds are darkened. And the point that I often make on that is because the gospel is veiled, it doesn't mean the law is. It means Christ is.
That's a good point.
Right.
That's a great point.
And
right.
you don't have to be regenerate to understand or to see the conviction of the law. But if we keep Christ from them, that keeps, I mean, that's just as effective as anything else in terms of being counterproductive towards evangelism. That's what Satan wants, to keep Christ and the gospel hidden.
Right.
And yet, on the other hand, it also points up the greatness of God in providing so much revelation in the law. I mean, there is so much there. Calvin has a whole section on how marvelously God has provided for civilization, even in its blindness. He said, despite their blindness in things heavenly, when it comes to things earthly, he says, are you really going to say that those who have invented medicine for our benefit are crazy? Are you really going to say that those who are philosophers and are brilliant in matters earthly are to be taken as madmen.
Some of your goofy Reformed say that sort of thing, don't they? Some of the ones you were referring to earlier?
Well, people who...
No common grace?
Yeah, people who deny common grace. But that must be... It must be said that is a fringe, very small group of people. That's a very... Mainstream Reformed theology has never allowed for a rejection of common grace. Cult and culture, or the way both Luther and Calvin put it, the two kingdoms. What's that distinction all about?
Well, at least in the beginning, Luther was trying to deal with the authority thing and found that it was broader than just authority in the church, and ended up saying, on this earth, there are two sorts of kingdoms, and they're not to be confused. The kingdom of the right is the kingdom of the church, and it is not given the sword by which to do its work, but the preached gospel and the sacraments. And the kingdom of the left is the kingdom of power, and has to do with everything other than a pastor preaching Christ and baptizing and giving the Lord's Supper. The kingdom of power has not to do with the gospel, and the government is not in business to further the gospel. This sort of thing is why we're really not very much looked to by the moral majority in this country as very helpful to the cause. But that distinction between the kingdom of the right and the kingdom of the left, many people who've never studied Luther are first drawn to reading him through that, not through the theology.
So if I walk into a church and the first thing I see on the back table in the narthex are voter guides.
You've got a confusion of kingdoms.
And there are Lutherans who get nervous if there's an American flag up in the front.
Well, there's some of us get a little nervous on the Reform side, too.
In fact, there's a great book on Reformed architecture that says that it is blasphemy to have a flag up front, a national flag. And it's amazing, when you travel around the world, you don't see national flags. It's really, I've only seen it in Britain and America.
Well, the flag to an American is like a queen to a Brit. You know, it occupies a sacred place that allows it to intrude upon what is genuine sacred space. And that's very, very unfortunate. I love my country as much as the next guy, but I'm not going to go to the Lord's house and worship my country.
Absolutely. I'm going to unfurl it in front of my house.
I'll shed blood for it, but I'm not going to worship it.
Exactly.
But didn't we see the confusion of the kingdoms early in the colonization of this country?
Yes.
When church membership, for instance, is required before you can register to vote or run for public office and things like that.
And Baptists are kicked out of Massachusetts.
Yes.
Vocation and ministry, another distinction that's helpful to keep in mind.
Well, this is the primary thing that Calvin adds, I think, to Luther's two kingdoms, and that is that every Christian, every creature, every human has a calling and a vocation. That is, there's a station in life to which they are called and they serve, and they discover that simply by identifying what they're good at and what they like doing. That you naturally gravitate towards those things to where you have gifts and interests. But ministry, on the other hand, is the specialized call to serve in a very specific capacity of preaching the Word of God and administering the sacraments. So while everyone has a calling and a vocation, there is a distinction made on the Reform side between a secular calling and a sacred calling. The secular calling not being inferior, as Rome would say, to the sacred calling, but governed by natural revelation. Whereas the call to the ministry is specifically governed by Scripture and is limited to those who are called by the church for the sacred ministry of word and sacrament.
So what happens when you've got a guy who comes to you and he says, I just had a
vision of Jesus,
radical conversion experience, and he's got a great quote-unquote testimony. That's the thing that's the phrase that pays these days, much more than education or how long you've been a Christian, all of these other things. The key thing is, it's almost better if you've been a Christian for a very short period of time, because then that testimony is fresh in your mind. Whereas Paul says, hey, make sure that you don't lay hands on somebody too quickly. Because he may be carried away. He's not mature enough.
You have another very similar circumstance appear, not so much with the testimony, but someone who has can play the guitar.
Yes.
Yeah, he knows five chords.
He knows five chords, therefore he's a minister of music.
Yeah, on the Lutheran side, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say that's, we see a very loose conception of ministry. Yep. And everything is titled ministry. And so people are ministers of puppetry or minister of dance, and everything is called ministry. And obviously the person who's over it is a minister.
Oh, absolutely.
Is this because we don't think that creation is very important? Only what comes within the sphere of redemption is important. Therefore, if you're not a Christian, you're not important to me. If you are not in the realm of evangelism, if something, if a practice or a vocation doesn't have something to do with evangelism or with piety, it's not important. Therefore, I have to show, if I'm going to invest my life in what's really important, I can't just be a good construction worker. I can't just be a good banker. I can't be just be a good CPA. I have to be a Christian CPA, or I have to... My favorite is on the radio where they have Christian divorce attorneys. You know, that's one of my personal favorites. And it's like, if you are new life this and new life that, if you just paste new life onto the front of your business and put a fish on your card, you have now made an otherwise irrelevant, unimportant activity spiritual.
That's the whole point of misunderstanding this category that really isn't the basis of the Protestant work ethic.
Yeah, in our circles, in Lutheran circles, the way it looks to me is it's radical egalitarianism. We have a history of the pastor being the boss over everything. The joke is Herr Pastor in German circles. And the answer back is to go the other wall. And so you have everybody's a minister. Well, Rick Ritchie wrote an article on that in Modern Reformation a while ago. That's what I think it's egalitarianism in our circles.
Yeah, everyone has a calling, but not everyone is a minister. And, and people are going to have to understand that not everyone who is a Christian is called to the ministry.
Exactly.
Well, of course, we can't go on. Wish we could. Remember, folks, we're not talking about the Reformation tradition here as if it provides the solution to the problem. What we're saying is the Reformation answers, we think, are biblical answers. They point us in the right direction. And the theology is much greater than the theologians themselves were in practice. That's going to be true of us too. But if our sanctification is secured already because of the victory won by Christ, then let us continue to pursue not only justice in our own individual sanctification, but in the church. And not only in the church, but in the world. Next week, we'll begin a new series. I hope you'll join us.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about supporting our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. That's whitehorseinn.org.